Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. Quick reminder, hey, you can do sponsorship for the IPv6 Buzz and all the other Packet Pusher podcast shows. So if you're interested, you can hit packetpushers.net/sponsorship. You can get all the details. And if you have IPv6 support in your product, we really want to hear about it. We'd love to be able to feature on the IPv6 Buzz. So come on, you know, sponsor up with us, and then we'll talk all about it and hopefully, you know, hear from you and hear how great your product is. I'm Ed Horley. I'm with my co-host Tom Coffey and Scott Hogan. Today, we're going to be talking about building IPv6 labs in general. Why don't we jump in and let's talk about building labs and the resources you need. So, I mean, what do you need, besides like all the crazy network gear? I mean, you know, what other resources do we think we need to have in a lab in order to get things up and working?
IPv6 isn't just a networking problem. It just isn't solely in the realm of the network engineer to solve. You got to generate some traffic end to end. So maybe a couple little nodes. They don't have to be expensive. Maybe a Raspberry Pi or two, or a old hand-me-down, you know, a Windows 7 laptop might work.
Windows 7 laptop?
I don't know.
Why not XP, Scott?
Yeah. practice loading that networking stack in the operating system. That's what we do. Yeah.
I mean, is the IPv6 features that much difference between 7 and 10 or 8? I mean,
well, it depends. I guess it depends on what patches you have on there. Because if you just have an original Windows 7 box, you're going to have older RFC 6724 behavior versus newer stuff. So there'll be weird things like that. But you know, V6 will still work. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. It'll completely work. So there's zero issue on that side. But yeah, I think all of us have done this, right? We've cobbled together a set of, you know, older laptops or older desktops, and we're like, hey, we're just going to install, you know, whatever our favorite, you know, Linux operating system is on there, and maybe run a, you know, few extra routers off on the side or some smaller network switch gear that's left over from a project or something like that. And you just get the code updated and start putting a few things together. So I think that, you know, that's not uncommon, I don't think. But if you want to run something that's sort of a little bit more intensive, that you might need a little bit beefier gear, right?
So, yeah, you probably need a DNS server, a DHCP server. You probably don't need IP address management if it's a small lab.
Right. Yeah. But if you want to be able to test out multiple operating systems, if you want to be able to test out multiple networking operating systems, and you maybe don't have, all the network gear itself, and you want to do something, you know, maybe virtualized or things of that nature, like that could definitely introduce maybe a little bit more workload than what a common laptop might be ready to do out of the gate, you know?
Yeah, I tend to think like a cheap old, you know, crusty network engineer, like, can I do this for $50? You know? But yeah, I mean, there are many options for building a lab. If you wanted to do this and you had a little bit of budget money and you were wanting to be serious about it, you could build not just physical devices like we talked about, a router, a laptop, but you could have virtualization systems or cloud or other things like that. Tom, I mean, what has been your experience building labs out of either physical, virtual, or cloud infrastructure?
Yeah, I think we should back up and maybe ask why you're building the lab in the first place, because there's different reasons why you would. I mean, if you're tasked with turning up IPv6 in your work environment, and obviously there's going to be a set of equipment and applications running on top of it that's going to sort of drive what your lab design is going to look like. If it's just a case where I just want to see how IPv6 works under the hood, then it's a little simpler. With the proviso that, you know, we're pretty much used to sort of focusing more on the network boxes. At least I am. I mean, you know, that's just being an old router lackey. You know, when I have time in the lab, I want to fire up the protocols and see how things are interacting related to routing. But of course, you know, with V6, that's maybe a part that's, I don't say it's trivial, but it's the part that's probably the easiest to configure and the part that doesn't maybe have as much going on to look at. It's like, oh, this works pretty much the same way in IPv6 as it did in IPv4. So, you know, yeah. So there, you know, maybe there's less to look at there, and you want to focus more on how IPv6 behaves at the host level, because that's where the neighbor discovery stuff is happening, and that's where it you know, you really the more of the complexity, I think, sort of shows up at the edge where it interfaces with servers and hosts and how Neighbor Discovery behaves and how Slack behaves and DHCPV6 and all of that.
You need the other side in order to tweak the NURB knobs, right?
And you kind of have to build a more host-centric lab. And you know, of course, we're used to doing that too, but we're maybe not used to thinking about doing that to help us examine a new networking protocol.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I guess there's three use cases. You know, the first one, you're just tinkering, you're doing some personal learning, you're just
being a nerd.
being a nerds. Second one, you need to get some experience on IPv6 and your focus is kind of doing an internet edge, internet perimeter deployment. So you just need kind of some of those services and compute elements and network gear that might be at a perimeter, a firewall, a couple routers, some small compute. Or the third one, you really have a legitimate reason, you're a larger enterprise and you want to do some formal comprehensive testing because you're planning for a large scale deployment. You could maybe split it into those three sizes, small, medium, and large.
Yeah, for sure. And then also depending on sort of if you're tasked with deploying it, we've always talked about sort of the high level of looking at how to deploy IPv6 and whether you're going to start in the core and move to the edge or start at the edge and move to the core or try to do both at the same time. There's different approaches and depends on the environment you're in, what you're going to use. So obviously that's going to impact what lab gear you're going to focus on. And I would think there's probably a lot of folks who've had the opportunity to turn up IPv6, at least in the core, and get it running as a routing protocol, get the network configured with it. It's not in production. So in a way, it's like you're turning the production network into a lab and, probably not telling anyone about it. Hopefully you're not running like single topology mode and having reconvergence for both address families and taking the network down. Not that I've ever done that.
Studying for an exam, are you? On production.
Well, I know Tom has spent a good amount of time working on some virtual and cloud lab configurations. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that, because it doesn't matter which one of these modes you want to do, you have to have a location to do it. And, physical investments can cost a lot of money unless maybe you have a bunch of Raspberry Pis laying around cheap or your office takes care of buying the entire, $2 million worth of lab gear that you want. But if they don't do that, we need more cost-effective options.
Yeah. For sure. Well, you've got these days, there's a ton of options related to just running labs completely virtually on a single laptop or in the case of certain lab environments like EvenG, you can run it in Google Cloud. I believe it actually runs in Azure as well. At least I've seen some GitHub repos out there where folks are at least claiming they have some configurations that work. I haven't tested it personally, but for GCP, it definitely works. And it's really nice to be able to scale up a lab to whatever your resource requirements are and have the cloud provide that. And then, of course, the issue back in the day, and this is still an issue with AWS, you can't run like the Qemu emulation. You can't run the nested virtualization doesn't work on all cloud platforms, but it's certainly working in Google Cloud. And so that's definitely a way to run an instance of EvenG and really, scale up the lab to what you need it to be.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, and it's cost effective because you can have it up when you want it and then spin it down when you don't want to use it. So it's definitely a great way to go. It's just, like me, like everyone else, right? You forget to spin it down.
You get the bill.
You get the bill and you're like, what? But yeah, that's
a different kind of education.
That's a cloud education that has nothing to do with V6,
that's right? That's
right.
Layer 8.
Yeah, totally. I don't know. I think, my experience so far with GCP and using that for running the EvenG, it seems to be more than capable in terms of being able to support what you would want to run in an environment and test and scale up. So I think if the audience wants to, scratch that itch and go check it out, there seems to be some pretty good resources to spin up and learn how to use that environment. So something you can
absolutely. And there's even a checkbox in the EvenG management interface to enable it over IPv6. So even the EvenG developers are thinking the right way about IPv6.
There you go. That's awesome.
Yeah. You could always go with, a small, just get a hosted server out there, DigitalOcean, IPv6onlyhosting.com, you know, and get yourself an IPv6 server to at least test from and do some experiments with. Some of the cloud providers, may bind you into, you know, being able to configure, you know, you may not have the ability to configure neighbor discovery as you may like. It may be fixed, right, you know, and have to do with their network underlay that they've built handles things in a certain way for you, and you don't have as much control as you may like if you had your own physical lab. Also, with a physical lab, you know, you can have that stimulus response. You can move the cables around. You can reconfigure the topology. You have a lot of flexibility there with a little lab.
You can go too far with that though, right? You know, you have your do all your tie wrap and, you know, all your layer one hygiene and, you know, just like back in the day in the data center. And then you're like, wait a second, this is just a lab in my basement. What am I doing?
Yeah, you can make it too restrictive. The idea is let a lab be a little messy, because if it's actively being used, then it should be a place for experimentation.
Yeah, fast reconfiguration as you discover that one cable that doesn't quite work right and costs you hours of missed lifetime opportunity to work on something.
This troubleshooting experience.
Run, as Scott says, running up and down the stairs to the basement. So you can not really sit next to the and then as we get older, it's risky. You know, it's like I'm going to slip on the stairs and break my hip.
Got to get my steps in. Get my vertical.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about, you know, most of us, I would say the majority of us over the time that we've been doing V6 labs, they've really been dual stack labs, right? You guys, I think that's been probably a true statement, is that everything that we've built has been like, okay, well, we all know how to run V4 networks and now we're going to do some V6, but it's really going to sort of be dual stack. We're not going to really strip V4 off. Has that been common experience for both of you two? I think that's been pretty standard.
Yeah, absolutely. And it makes it difficult to isolate, you know, which protocol is actively being used. So you often, you know, you either have a browser plugin that might tell you something or about where the connection, you know, was made over which protocol, or you have a protocol analyzer, you open up Wireshark and, you know, you'll watch some videos by Jeff Carroll and other folks on how to get deep into that. But yeah, we've talked about on this show, running dual protocol may hide or mask some of what's going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, it depends on sort of the extensiveness of the test that you're doing, right? I mean, if you're doing end-to-end application testing, you know, it's like, okay, I got the V6 network up and the V6 edge up, and now let's test and see how apps behave. And for, you know, most of us, that's going to be like the ones that we would expect, the web and SSH and things like that. But yeah, it does become a little problematic. And so, of course, the nice thing about a virtual environment is that you can really, it's maybe a little easier to control that. You can, you know, like in a bout of just total pointless masochism, I decided, I know Cisco says that VXLAN, EBGP, EVPN doesn't work with a V6 underlay. But I'm just going to try it out and test it out anyway. And, you know, built the entire, and, you know, built in a virtual environment. It's, you can just have V4 can be completely off. Of course, it's just routers. So, but yeah, it just really depends on what you're testing.
Yeah. In a cloud, if you're in a public cloud infrastructure, you may not have the ability to turn V4 off.
That's right.
Dual or V4. Yeah,
that's true. If you're running inside of EVNG, then you can run it as V6 only. So it doesn't matter whether that's on a public cloud or not. You can run a V6 only sort of configuration. And that I think that's, to Tom's point, you have the option. It's been unusual for us in the past, you know, to do a V6 only lab. I think that's something new that's really sort of going on now, is folks are like, you know what, we actually need to do this as V6 only. Can we get everything to operate that way? Can we ensure that all the things that we need to do, right, are actually capable of running in a V6 only environment? And that's a new lesson for a lot of organizations and even for us, right? Is sort of saying like, hey, let's see if we can operationally make all of this stuff happen V6 only.
Well, and there's a bit of a stick now, right, with the new federal mandate for for government agencies, right? They have to be able to do this.
Yeah, yeah. There's that's I think that's probably partially the reason we're seeing some pickup in interest around that is there's a lot more organizations saying like, we need to figure this out, and how do we figure this out? And there's, I think there's a whole set of problems that go along with that, right? Yeah. Besides just the, you know, V6 only side of the equation. I think there's other things like it's great. They probably have many organizations have a lab of some type, whether that's physical, whether that's dedicated hardware, whether that's, you know, some sort of virtual environment. They've got some sort of lab that they test their change configuration in before they push it to production. I think that's a common thing. But my question now is, how hard is it to switch back and forth? Because if you need to test a V4 only feature, you could have run through and quickly turned off your V6, I guess. If you were trying to test a V6 only feature, I don't know very many people that turn off their V4 and still have an operational lab.
It's funny you say, you use the word interest. Like, there's a lot more interest in this. I don't know. Interest is that that's like the
that's
panic?
The polite way.
The,
yeah, that's the polite way of saying that there's
the adjective was
yeah.
The panic. Morbid curiosity.
Morbid curiosity. But then I was just thinking, like, as you're describing that, it's like I think about the vendors who've been able to sort of BS their way through the V6 support thing, knowing that, you know, most folks are just going to fall back to V4 for a lot of different applications and traffic flows and whatnot. There's nowhere to hide. You know, it's like V6 only. Oh yeah, we totally support V6. Yeah. Yeah. So I can turn this V6 only and it'll totally work. It's like they pull their collars, you know.
Yeah. It may seem crazy to try and test V6 only, but I think if you're gonna do testing, make it comprehensive. You get one shot at it, you're gonna set up a lab, test it dual, and then take that next little step of effort, test V6 only, and then you know better where you stand for the long term. If you just test a dual, then a year from now, you're going to come back in the lab to do the same things over again. And you're like, how was it configured? I moved things around. What was up? Take the extra 10, 15 minutes or the little bit extra that it will take you to test V6 only. And I think you'll learn a lot by doing that process, right?
Yeah.
But do it while you're in the moment and then it really is a side by side. It's apples and oranges, and then just oranges. and isolate one from the other.
Well, and what sort of testing then? I mean, so if we talk about, you know, if we're gonna go through the trouble of doing the V6 only testing while we're testing some of the other things, I mean, what are some of the steps that we can take? I mean, there's some obvious ones, like you've turning off IPv4 at the network interface level, et cetera, but that's not always possible. What are some of the ways we can sort of work around that?
Yeah, I mean, you could just not put an IPv4 address on the router interface, but then not do an IP helper on your Cisco router interface, but then your hosts end up with a PIPA addresses, 169.254 addresses, failing DHCP for IPv4. And then maybe that router does have a V6 address, sends a routing advertisement, the host does that, but the host ends up with still kind of a little bit of V4 in it.
It's still there. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where it's difficult, especially in Windows. Like so let's talk about the differences, because the operating systems, I guess, is what we're talking about diving into now, right? In Windows, you really can't turn V4 or V6 off in the operating system itself. Versus Linux and OS X, we have the options of actually turning one off or the other, right? In terms of testing and sort of compatibility. So it becomes a little easier. There's drawbacks, pluses and minuses to both. You're just going to have to deal with the PIPA addresses being on the host operating system for a while within the Windows side, and just understanding the behavior differences. The downside of having a PIPA addresses on there and still having something like maybe link local multicast name resolution running is that your hosts are still going to try and talk to each other if they can do name discovery that way. If they're on the same L2, they're going to do that. And then if you're foolish enough that you think you want to test ULA in your lab and you think you're going to get V6 to work over ULA and you still got a PIPA working with link local multicast, you're still not going to see any V6 traffic because, you know, ULA
gets no respect.
No, it gets no respect, man. Because ULA's deprefed, right? It's deprefed in the precedence order. So IPv4 is preferred over ULA. So if you have any IPv4, you're that's
169, it. 254. It's like, oh, sorry, ULA. I've got priority.
Yeah, it just stomps all over you. So even when IPv4 is functionally useless because it's a self-assigned an address and it can't even route outbound and it's not even accepted on the public internet, it still doesn't let you run ULA.
Yeah. Pippa, I was Link Local before Link Local was cool, man.
It's too funny. Yeah, but that's the reality, hard reality. And then, you know, maybe a lab is good for this because you start figuring this stuff out. You start, you know, seeing this behavior actually in your lab. You're like, ooh, I know why it's doing that.
And of course, you can use security gear to break IPv4 on purpose, you know, just if you
want. And IPv6.
Put in an access list. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. Or filters. We can definitely put filters on and we could kill that traffic. You could do both, you know, L2 and L3 filters, depending on what you want to do. We can kill those ether types, right? So they don't even go down on the wire. So you can prevent that multicast discovery. Yep. So depending on what you want to do and how hard you want to test in your lab, you know, and you can definitely do this even on the Windows firewall if you want. You could kill that traffic there. So
yeah, once you think you've got, you know, V4 turned off or disabled or somehow, you know, hamstrung on the host, then you may still want to use a protocol analyzer and see if there's any V4 packets still on the network. See what traces of systems may be still trying to grasp. Hey, I'm still here. IPv4, please.
There's still some little
IPv6 desert. There may still be little IPv4 people running around, very parched, very dehydrated.
That's right.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And there's tons of behavior like that. And some of it you don't control from the operating system side, but they could be applications that you're running that are doing that behavior set to learn and do discovery. They may leverage ports of the OS, or they may choose to do it themselves directly with the networking stack. And you don't know until you actually run that stuff in your lab and you're like, look what it's doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think DNS could be a useful way to observe things that are still trying to do DNS lookups for IPv4A records, because that could be coming over IPv6 transport.
Yep.
But there still could be some application that's looking up for an A record.
Yeah, well, yeah. And that's legitimate, right? The app shouldn't care. It should just ask for a name and it shouldn't care whether it's A or quad A that it gets back, right, from the operating system. So the operating system is probably going to try and resolve the best it can both ways, right?
Well, and we shouldn't gloss over that for folks that are new to V6, because it's one of those things where, you know, there's some separation between V4 and V6, chips in the night and address families. And, you know, at the network layer, we sort of just accept that. And then of course, as soon as you start working with DNS and it's like, oh wait, I can get an A record over IPv6 and I can get a quad A record over IPv4. And it's like, there's no distinction.
So yeah, here we are back mingling it all again.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And so from a troubleshooting perspective, that can be like, that can really throw you for a loop initially.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I think that's a big one that, you know, it's one of those items that catches a lot of people off guard, along with the persistence checks that the Windows operating system does, you know, when it initially boots to determine whether V6 is actually viable to use or not. And Scott has some really good stuff talked about in the past around, you know, NCSI, the network connection status indicator, because if it doesn't pass that check, it falls back to V4. So even though you go through all this effort to set up your V6 only lab, right, it's sitting there and checking and determining, and it will still use a V6 address if you put, you know, in hard brackets, you know, or a direct ping or something like that, and you have an address configured on your interface, it will use it as instructed. But in terms of default behavior for happy eyeballs, in terms of trying to query, if it doesn't see an active internet connection, it's like, sorry, we're not going to use that. So we're not going to use any V6 because we don't think it's actually available. And you may be running your lab in isolation. It's not actually connected to the V6 internet, right? Mm-hmm. You're using documentation prefix just to test stuff out. And so you need to spoof that sort of stuff. Just some small checklist items, but I think those are important.
It's important to mention. Yeah, so if you're using another address space, IPv6 address space that is registered to someone else or documentation prefixed, it's an isolated lab, those Windows hosts can't phone home to that V6 only NCSI site that Akamai maintains, then they fall back to using IPv4, thinking V6's brokenness is occurring in some way.
Which is a problem in an IPv6 only lab, because you have no V4.
So you could solve that with NAT 6.6. Maybe that'll be another show.
Yeah. NAT and IPv6, I don't know. That's just not right, Scott.
NAT 6.6, it's a thing. It's a thing. Just saying.
It's a thing. Yeah, I think, I don't know. I mean, I think the other challenge is going to be like, how do you get from a V4, you know, you've got this expensive lab, maybe you do have hardware. How do you get back and forth to test all the environments? I mean, how, what are you going to use to get V4 only lab, and then you need a dual stack your lab, then you need to run V6 only lab, and then, you know, your app team walks in and says, well, our app only works on V4s. Can you flip the lab back? And you just spent the last 2 hours turning on all your V6 and turning off all your V4. It's like,
yeah, put it back, V6 nerd.
Yeah. I think this is where automation and scripting is probably going to make a lot of sense for those that are running in lab environments, or, you know, using the virtual one that Tom talked about, then you're just, you know, turning one lab off and turning another lab on. Right.
But yeah, that's a great question, Ed, because typically in a lab, you're doing a lot of things manually. Because it's the first time you've ever done them, you know.
Yep.
Conf-T, interface, gig 0/0, IPv6 address, blah, /64, press return, RA gets sent, same to Slack. Like, wait a minute, okay. You know, you're in there and you're doing a lot of these things manually off in the lab because you're learning as you go. So you're not automating. So then when you have to strip out IPv6, it's strip it out manually.
Right.
Now, if you were a smart network engineer and you thought about the long term, you know, further ahead, you're like, well, hang on a second. I should be scripting my V6 deployment in the lab, because not only am I learning about scripting, but when it comes time to deploy IPv6, do I want to type all this in manually? So by building the scripts and learning the automation techniques in the lab, you're learning how to automate the production rollout.
Mm-hmm.
And then also then you could automate and roll it back, right?
Yeah, that would be in theory, but I'm fortunately fit in the first category.
Me too. Yeah, I admit. Me too.
But that's, you know, that's how you start. I mean, I think all of us, as we've all learned over time, right? You end up building networks three times, right? The first time you're tinkering around, you're trying to figure out, you know, break. You try and make it better the next time. And then hopefully by the third time, you've got that. You've got a pretty good idea about what you need to do and how you need to build it. And it comes out right correctly the third time through.
There's potentially the fourth time when you're doing it home after having lost your job, trying to figure out
what I'm wrong. Resume generator.
Yeah, when you did the automation, but you did it incorrectly. It's V6 deployment at scale. It's turned off V4 at scale.
I was listening to this IPv6 Buzz podcast. They said I could do this in the middle of the day and no one would notice.
That's right. Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, it's, I think the great advantage is maybe, you can learn two sets of skills at the same time within your lab, how to automate, how to script, and how to do this with V6. And you get sort of the excuse to do both at the same time. And then you would be automating V4 too, because if you want to do V4 only and you have to strip out all the V6, if you want to strip out all the V4 in order to be able to do V6 only, dual stack, the combination, and then the transition protocol elements of being able to say like, hey, I want to turn on NAT 6.4 and I want to try NAT 6.4, DNS 6.4, or I want to try some sort of server load balancing, or I want to try, you know, some other method, you know, I want to do SIT, or I want to do something else, or I want to play with MAPT and MAPB. You know, each one of those are going to be small use cases within the lab, and you're going to want to be able to automate to turn those on and off. And you're probably going to have to turn other parameters on and off within the network to point to those resources. So instead of having to go touch, you know, let's say you build a bigger virtual environment lab, instead of having to touch 20 routers, you can be like, I run the script and it cleans that stuff up for me and then puts it back in when I need it. So in theory.
I think isn't all of our podcasts, we just, in theory.
It's in theory.
In theory quotes.
Well, I think a bunch of people talk about that as just V6 is in theory. And maybe, you know, I think one of the things that becomes common for everyone in the lab is one of the reasons you're standing all this up is so that you can actually observe behavior, right? We want to be able to observe a set of behaviors. And so maybe we talk really quickly, just really fast. I mean, how do you guys go about actually seeing that you're getting what you expected or didn't expect in the lab?
Protocol analyzer, Wireshark.
Yeah, that's it for me too. A lot of time. Well, logs. And the first thing I do is check logs and simple routing stuff. I'll look for, you know, neighbor adjacency comes out. Do I see the routes on the other side? Things like that. But I would agree. Typically, it's some sort of Wireshark protocol analyzer or log files that I'm digging through and being like, oh, I got the behavior I expected to see. Post operating system got an IP address, IPv6 address. It's able to route out. And if I'm connected to the V6 internet, I'm able to get to resources. So.
Yeah, I splunk that stuff.
Yeah, too funny. Well, hey, unlike V6, we've run out of space for this podcast. Thanks for joining us today. Scott, how can folks follow you on the internet?
At Scott Hogue on Twitter, ScottHogg.
And Tom?
At IPv6 Tom.
All right, and you can follow me. I'm at E. Horley. And you can also reach the IPv6 Buzz podcast on Twitter at IPv6 Buzz and hit us up with any questions. We love to hear from folks. We'd love to be able to have more listener shows with questions and answers. Those are always awesome. It's always great to hear what people are working on and what folks are up to. So please do that. Thanks for listening to the IPv6 Buzz. You can find us on the Packet Pushers or any of your favorite podcast apps. Just search for IPv6 Buzz. If you like the show, please give us a rating on iTunes. You know, hopefully you're listening on Spotify too. And if you like this podcast, we really recommend you check out Heavy Networking, Day 2 Cloud, Network Break, you know, all the other great technical content over at packetpushers.net. If you don't know, Packet Pushers has a newsletter called Human Infrastructure Magazine. It's just sort of loaded with the best sort of stuff that they found on the internet, has feature articles, commentary, everything else. It's free, doesn't suck. And you can get the next issue over at packetpushers.net/newsletter. So long, and until next time, we'll see you on the internet. The IPv6 internet, that is.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.